Welcome to The Bridge, a weekly magazine show featuring local and regional stories. I'm Kathleen Morgain. Oregon ballot measure 90 would create a nonpartisan primary for all candidates. The top two would advance to the general election regardless of party. It's similar to the system now in place in Washington, where some say a dominant political party can prevent any other party from getting a candidate on the ballot.
We're in the quandary now that we have to vote for somebody we don't like or don't vote.
Chris Lehman talked with supporters and detractors of the system. That story coming up just after NPR News headlines. Also on the show, an investigation into farm workers facing sexual harassment. Jacob Lewin reports more women are coming forward and speaking out. Plus, Clatsop Economic Development Resources has help for people who have an idea for a new business but need assistance in planning to get their ideas off the ground. NPR News headlines are next. The time is 9:01. You're listening to The Bridge on Coast Community Radio. I'm Kathleen Morgain. This fall, Oregon voters will choose between five candidates for U.S. Senator and six candidates for governor. It could be the last time the general election ballot is this crowded in Oregon. That's because one of the initiatives up for a vote this year, Measure 90, would create a nonpartisan primary for all candidates. The top two would advance to the general election, regardless of party. It's similar to the election system already in place in Washington state. Salem correspondent Chris Lehman reports.
Let's start this story in Washington's 4th Congressional District. It's east of the Cascades and stretches all the way from the Oregon line up to the Canadian border. Not a lot of Democrats call it home. Even fewer get elected.
Well, we're active.
Yakima County Democratic Party Chair Danny Adolph says at least they're trying, but in this fall's congressional election, victory will be impossible for his party. That's because the top two vote-getters in the August primary were both Republicans. So what's a Democrat like Danny Adolph to do? Hold your nose and choose between, his words, the lesser of two evils.
I say that metaphorically. I don't say that either one of those guys are evil, but we're in the quandary now that we have to vote for somebody we don't like or don't vote.
It's a real-life scenario like this that gives political parties the willies. But supporters of the top two primary system say it's not necessarily a bad outcome.
Not all candidates of a political party are created equally.
Sal Peralta is the secretary of the Independent Party of Oregon. He says a general election with two candidates from the same party could offer a real choice to voters who don't usually have a meaningful say in the outcome of a general election. Let's say you have a legislative district in the middle of Portland that's overwhelmingly D. The winner of the primary is effectively the winner of the general election, and anyone who's not a Democrat didn't have a say in the matter. The same thing happens east of the Cascades, where Republicans vastly outnumber Democrats. Measure 90 would allow all voters, regardless of party, to cast a vote for any candidate in the primary. Peralta says that would mean candidates would have to appeal to a wider array of voters, starting in the primary.
The goal is to create a system that doesn't reward partisanship, that rewards candidates who appeal to all voters, regardless of party affiliation. And the ultimate goal, I think, is to create better policy outcomes.
The prospect of reducing partisanship is hammered home in a TV commercial for Measure 90, which features a bunch of people in suits playing tug of war.
They fight and argue, push and shove, but nothing gets done. Oregon can break partisan gridlock with Measure 90.
Ironically, even before Election Day, the measure has already succeeded in bringing Democrats and Republicans together. Both parties have come out strongly against the top two primary initiative. Sarah Logue is the spokeswoman for the Protect Our Vote Coalition, which has formed to fight Measure 90.
It damages our democracy because it gives the minority of the population the majority of the influence over who we can vote for.
She says it's already a problem that few people vote in a primary. She believes that letting two candidates of the same party end up on the general election ballot will take choices away from the larger number of November voters.
I just believe that we should have more choice on our general election ballot. I know that I don't feel the same as some of my friends politically, And when I look at a general election ballot, I want to be able to find someone who represents my values and my voice on that ballot to vote for.
For now, to vote in a primary for a partisan office, Oregon voters have to belong to a major political party. And for now, that means the one-third of Oregon voters with no major party affiliation can't. Measure 90 would change that, too. This isn't the first time Oregonians will vote on a top-two primary measure. A similar initiative failed by a wide margin in 2008. I'm Chris Slaman in Salem.
September is one of the big harvest months for Oregon agriculture. Apples, pears, hops. It's also a time when fields are full of farm workers, a large percentage of whom may be subject to sexual harassment. It's a subject that has long been taboo, but a growing number of women are speaking out. Jacob Lewin reports.
Every day at her job at a vineyard outside Salem, things were the same for Clarissa.
Pues como chiquita, miji, todas esas cosas le decía.
Her boss would comment on her body, ask her out, touch her hair. Other times, it would be a coworker who would threaten her if she said no.
Golpearme o cosas así. Y que ya sabía dónde vivía.
Say he would beat her up and that he knew where she lived. She says it happened to all the women at the vineyard. That rings true for Melina León, a counselor at Salem's Center for Hope and Safety.
What I hear from the National Center for Farm Workers is that 9 in 10 women are victims of sexual harassment on the fields. And they just think that it's part of what they have to put up with to keep their work.
Oregon has about 150,000 farm workers, a third of whom are women. Many don't speak English and feel they have to keep their jobs because there are few alternatives. Ramon Ramirez, president of PICUN, the Farm Workers Union and Social Service Organization, says that gives supervisors a lot of power. He says more of the complaints he sees are physical in nature.
Touching, having sex in the fields, in the restrooms. It's not unusual for a foreman to separate the victim and put them in a part of the field where there's nobody at, and then that's where the problem happens.
There are also reports of a significant amount of male-on-male harassment. The problem's been going on for decades. What's new is the number of women coming forward to complain. PICUN has its own small radio station in Woodburn.
La radio comunitaria llegando a tus oídos, 95.9 en FM.
Ramirez says the station had been running announcements asking victims of harassment to come forward, but had to cut them back.
We're just inundated with complaints. The last time we did an announcement, immediately we had more than 50 women come in. And that's just the tip of the iceberg, really. They always talk in the third person, and then later on we find out that they're the actual victims. And it's not only a problem that exists in the piece rate crops, but it's a problem that exists in nurseries also.
It's been a problem here at Van Essen Nursery in Lebanon. But the nursery was one of the early agricultural employers to try to get out in front of the problem. Business manager Rhonda Wiehe says other employers are now doing the same.
I think they have changed. They are becoming proactive and listening to their employees. What I feel has changed is, in our company, the desire to provide a safe work environment for employees. It's important to us that the employees enjoy coming to work.
Van Essen was amongst the first to have a sexual harassment policy and training for supervisors and employees. So when two women came forward with complaints, WEA disciplined the supervisor. Tim Bernasek is legal counsel for the Oregon Farm Bureau.
It is the rare complaint that I see that doesn't have some aspect of harassment. There has been an increase in the number, at least the allegations of this activity.
Bernasek says he is seeing dozens and dozens of these complaints, and he thinks it's the growers' efforts that are causing the rise.
There's been a huge increased effort to educate agricultural employers about processes and procedures that need to be put in place to avoid these issues from happening in the first place.
Bernasek acknowledges that a series of recent investigations by the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission is one of the drivers of that effort. Some of the investigations resulted in substantial fines. Farm workers advocates like Melina León say that's a bright spot because local police rarely get involved.
Most of the people that work on the fields are undocumented, so they're afraid of the police. They don't see them as people that they can get help from, so they won't report. And it is really common that they get raped.
For Ramon Ramirez, the issue is reaching a tipping point.
I'm sure they have policies. I mean, this is against law, period. I'm sure they're saying that they're doing something, but they're not doing enough. And I call on the Farm Bureau and all the grower associations to really take some leadership here and really make a difference.
Ramirez says Picun is doing initial planning for a series of protests. I'm Jacob Lewin in Salem.
In Spokane, Washington, about 15 police officers are donning body cameras as a trial run before the whole department starts to wear them next year. Paige Browning reports officers have found the small square cameras have lots of quirks, both technically and ethically.
Spokane Police Chief Frank Straub will be the first to say body cameras are a good idea, primarily because he says it will encourage better behavior both from officers and the public. Officers legally must announce they are recording when they interact with citizens. But when Straub releases body camera policies and outfits all officers in January, he says deciding when to turn them on will be difficult.
Everything is not just the police that are being recorded, it's you. If I'm talking to you, I'm recording him, I'm recording this woman over here, all at the same time. Is that appropriate to put all of that material out there for public consumption?
Straub says anything recorded will have to be made available for public record requests. He posed rhetorical questions to a room of reporters Friday, like what should an officer do if in a private home and one resident wants the camera on, but one requests it be turned off? What about if a citizen is having a mental health crisis? Police took reporters through a virtual simulation, which they're also doing with community groups and city staff. This made other possible problems obvious. In one simulation, a suspect has a gun hanging out of his pocket, and officers shoot him as he grabs it. But on body camera footage, the suspect's gun is not visible.
Sir, put it down. Put it down.
The Spokane Police Department will present the body cameras at community meetings throughout this fall, in part to answer questions and to show that even when used correctly, the cameras aren't perfect. In Spokane, I'm Paige Browning.
You're listening to The Bridge here on Coast Community Radio, 91.9 KMUN Astoria and 89.5 KTCB Tillamook. I'm Kathleen Morgane. Still ahead, in Ashland, some people who rent rooms or couches in their homes on a nightly basis through online companies like Airbnb are clashing with traditional lodging operators and neighborhood associations. Proponents of the casual rentals say the fight is really about a single issue.
Nobody wants to come out and say, what is the real issue here? It's the M word. It's money.
Some say the operators are undermining single-family neighborhoods. We'll hear about the controversy coming up right after this weather break. Here's the National Weather Service forecast for the Lower Columbia Coastal Region. Today, cloudy with a 50% chance of showers, highs 65 to 70 with light winds. Rainfall amounts around a tenth of an inch. Then tonight, mostly cloudy, a 20% chance of showers, overnight lows in the mid-50s. Gordon McCraw, meteorologist and director of Tillamook Emergency Management, says as the low drifts toward the southeast today, the activity will become more scattered. Then this evening, high pressure starts to build in once again, so improving conditions can be expected tomorrow. We could have some patchy fog tomorrow morning, otherwise becoming partly sunny tomorrow afternoon and partly cloudy overnight with east winds setting up for Saturday, which means dry, warm, and possibly smoky conditions with a high in the low 80s possible Saturday, easing some on Sunday as a weak system approaches, reversing the flow to onshore, which helps cool things back down. The start of next week looks more seasonable. The marine clouds move in at night, bringing back some in the afternoon. Cooler temperatures with highs in the upper 60s to near 70. New online companies have emerged where private residents offer travelers a place to stay for the night, often at rates cheaper than hotels or bed and breakfasts. The private lodging operators don't face the same regulations and health and safety requirements, and most don't pay taxes. From Ashland, Bill McLean reports that traditional innkeepers are crying foul.
Drivers use their smartphone to sell the space when they vacate a prime downtown parking spot. Chase says he's convinced Ashland innkeepers are just trying to protect their own profits because a website called Couchsurfing also helps travelers find overnight accommodations, but with a twist. It's free.
The only difference between that and what we're proposing is an exchange of money. Impact is the exact same, and the city does not disallow this.
Ashland City Council member Rich Rosenthal says this peer-to-peer marketplace is a new animal that defies traditional regulations, and no matter what the city does, Rosenthal says people will continue to use these websites.
That's going to be there no matter what the council decides. Whether the council chooses to regulate that type of business or to allow it to basically be a black market.
Last March, Portland became the first city in the nation to let Airbnb pay the hotel occupancy tax on behalf of those who post rooms for rent, with requirements that are less formal and less expensive than those for traditional innkeepers. Rosenthal says Portland's new regulation is interesting, but he says in Ashland it might not be appropriate to allow a more lenient regulatory structure for private residents than for businesses that provide the same service. Chase says he sees that writing on the wall and holds out little hope Ashland will seek the compromise that Portland did.
I think that if anything is passed, it's going to be so restrictive that it's going to severely limit the number of people who are going to be able to do it. It's going to be, okay, we got our win, but most of us can't do this anyway.
Nobody's quite sure how this issue will shake out in Ashland, but consensus among the parties involved is that it could be early next year before the council takes action. I'm Bill McLean reporting.
The so-called sharing economy is shaking up more traditional business models, but that doesn't stop people with an idea and a dream from setting up shops and businesses of their own. Research and planning in advance can avoid unpleasant and costly surprises that force some new business owners to close before they really get started. Clatsop Economic Development Resources, or CEDR, has helped hundreds of people turn their ideas into reality. One of those people is now helping others with their own business plans.
With me in the studio this morning is Tom Liner. He is going to be instructing the Ready, Set, Start Your Business program with Clatsop Economic Development Resources. The next class is going to be in Seaside next week. And Tom, can you talk to us a little bit about what's going to be covered in the class?
Hi, sure. What we'll be covering next week in our program is the basic elements that it takes to start a business. In Astoria, or actually anywhere in the country for that matter. We cover some of the basics like licensing, the type of business entity you'd like to be, and of course, whatever type of product, service, or whatever that you might be providing, then that, of course, may create another need for different permitting and inspections, building requirements, and whatnot like that.
Now, you have a lot of so-called street cred, because you are involved with a small business here in Astoria, the Pat's Pantry Spice Shop. And how long ago did you start up this business?
We started just not quite 2.5 years ago. And it was a wonderful experience for us because we actually used the Small Business Development Center. I met with Dick Powell a number of times before we actually made that final decision and pulled the trigger to open the store in Astoria.
And what advice did you get starting out?
It was good. You know, Dick brought up some great information about storefront locations. He made some recommendations for utilities. It sounds simple enough, but actually it can be more complicated than you might expect. He gave us background information about CEDR and what the kind of classes that they offer here. That was very helpful.
Did you start out thinking, we want to operate an urban spice shop, or did you know what your business was going to be? Did you have the dream?
Absolutely, we had the dream. We were going to open it in Portland where we were living. Well, I'll be honest, we got scared. We got chicken. We go, let's go to Astoria. If we can make it in Astoria, we can make it anywhere, you know? So that's what we did, and it's now given us some time under our belt where we feel seasoned in the spice industry. Pat's a copious reader of blogs, magazines, watching emails, e-zines about the food industry. And now we've got huge connections in Portland. That's just added to our flavor here in Astoria.
When you started out, did you locate on commercial? You have a lot of foot traffic there. You've got people walking past. Are you primarily, your customers see the shop, or do they come from elsewhere?
Initially, they just saw the shop. We were down literally three doors to the west when we started for the first 2 years in a nice store location there. And then the one that became available that we're currently in now for the past five, almost 6 months. And it turned out to be a wonderful opportunity because our lease was up at the other location. So we literally picked up the store and carried it down the street. And that's worked out really nicely. It's more food pantry-ish, tall ceiling. It used to be, in 1923, it opened up as a meat market. So it was food-related back then, and so now it's turned full circle and back to being food.
Are you doing things at your new location that you didn't do at your former location?
Actually, the format is the same. It's more conducive to doing what we were trying to do at the other location. The other store was spread out. It was a long walk to the back room. It was set up as a gallery. It's now reassumed to be another gallery, which is nice. That's what it's intended to be. And our location is more conducive to doing sit-downs where people can come in, feel more comfortable, relaxed. We have some stools there at a little tasting table so they can sample different things.
How has the business evolved in the sense, if you had an initial vision, how did the actual practice of owning and operate the business change that vision over time?
It hasn't changed that much. That's one of the things that Pat and I put a lot of time into. We looked at our business plan, our business model. We modified, we dialed it in. We always left some room for some variations, you know, some sort of wiggle room in there. But we've pretty much stayed right on track of what our initial business plan was and found it to be very workable and doable. The big change is that when we first opened up, within literally the first week or two, someone came in and said, I really like your herbs de Provence. I can't have rosemary. Can you make it with something else? And Pat said, I'll make it for you with sage. And she looked at me. She says, hey, I think we're onto something. So what we found out was by that experience of making this person a special blend for him is that doing our own handcrafted, hand-blended spices has become a big part of our business niche.
So you're a walking, talking example of what a good marketing plan can do.
Yes.
You've been in business over 2 years now?
Just short of 2.5 years.
You're definitely walking the talk.
Right.
When people start out with a business idea and they run with it, you were saying earlier that 34% of businesses fail in their first year?
Yes. Yeah, the statistics from the Small Business Administration is that 34% of businesses fail in the first year. And that's due to lack of planning, which may include appropriate funding, knowing their market, knowing their competition, things like that.
This class will give you the tools to avoid being one of those statistics.
Certainly, the intention of the whole program is that they leave much more well-informed about what it takes to run a business. And then, of course, this is just an overview program. Then you get free counseling after this. And that's the one thing that I really hope people take away as they go, oh my gosh, I can have an advisor that I can bounce an idea off of. There's a plethora of information that we have and resources that we can help this person tap into to find out, to validate their business plan even more.
Okay, the class is Ready, Set, Start Your Business, and it's going to be taught in Seaside next week, but then you'll be alternating between Seaside and Astoria?
The plan is that there will be a monthly program. 1 month will be in Seaside, 1 month will be here in Astoria. Yes.
Okay, Tom Liner, advisor for Clatsop Economic Development Resources, thank you so much for coming in to talk about the Ready, Set, Start Your Business program.
Thank you.
The next Seaside class is Wednesday, September 24th from 8:30 to 10:30 a.m. at the Clatsop Community College South County Campus, 1455 North Roosevelt Drive. To register, call 503-338-2402.
That's all the time we have for today's show. The Bridge airs weekly, Thursday mornings at 9. If you joined us late, you can listen to a podcast from our website at coastradio.org. Just click the program box on the homepage. We welcome your comments. Call us at 503-325-0010 or email to news1, that's NEWS, then the numeral 1, at KMUN.org. I'm Kathleen Morgain saying thank you for listening today, and listen in again next Thursday for the next edition of The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.